It's time now for the Truth Restoration Bible Study Conference Call. You'll hear various Bible teachers as guests, and you'll also have an opportunity to voice your thoughts. We record every Wednesday at noon Pacific time. Join the conversation next week. Visit truthrestoration.com to find out how. Now, let's jump into today's study.
Hello, thanks for joining us for the Truth Restoration Bible Study Conference Call. Today, we're talking about a topic that is intriguing to me, and I hope it is to you. And it's about the ministry of the Messiah, the ministry of Jesus, and specifically the length of time. If it was a 3.5-year ministry, 70-week ministry, we're going to look at some prophecy in Daniel and others that relate to that. So I think it's pretty intriguing. I think it should be fun. Before we jump in, I'm going to go ahead and open us up in prayer, and then we'll jump in. And so, Father in heaven, we thank you for this day. We thank you for every blessing. Thank you for the opportunity to study your word freely in this country. And we just thank you for your presence with us. We ask you to help us to be humble in our conversation and that we would glorify you in the name of your son. Amen. And so before we jump in, you may be familiar or maybe not with this book called The Chronological Gospels. It's put together by Michael Rood, and basically he layers the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in such a way that it fits. So a lot of times you might read one thing over here and read something else over in another one of the books, Mark or Luke, and it seems like an apparent contradiction, or it seems like, hey, that was before it or after it, or the sequence sometimes is a little bit awkward. So I think he does a great job of putting these things together in sequence. And it's very interesting. So with that, he comes up with the conclusion that it was a 70-week ministry of the Messiah. And I think there's some great grounds for that. And one of the things, of course, that relates to is the prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, starting in verse 24. And I'll go ahead and read this section from 24 through 27. And this will kind of kickstart our conversation here. So 70 weeks are determined for your people and for your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublesome times. Then continuing in verse 26, and after the 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood, and till the end of the war, desolations are determined. Then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering, and on the wing of abominations shall be one who makes desolate, even until the consummation, which is determined, is poured out on the desolate. So that's through verse 27, and there's a lot here, but I just wanted to point out one of the things that is just so, I don't know if ironic is the right word, but it's just bizarre to me, and that is at the beginning of 27, it says, then he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. And many very brilliant people that I know, that I respect and have a great deal of respect for, see this as the he there, then he shall confirm a covenant, as the Messiah, that he shall confirm a covenant for 1 week. And in the midst of the week, and they talk about in the midst of the week that he was crucified, and then he makes an end of sins and finishes the transgression, all this stuff. And so it ties in, very good. And so it's one way. Other people that I have a great deal of respect for see it absolutely 100% opposite, and that the he who shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week is the Antichrist or the Anti-Messiah. And so it's just a wild thing. It's wild. But anyway, without going into that and my thoughts on that, I'm just curious to see if anybody else has any comments on this verse, or if you wanted to tie in maybe the 490 years using the day for a year, and how translating from 70 weeks goes into the 490 years from when the command was given to rebuild Jerusalem, rebuild the temple, and then brings you right up until the time of the Messiah, time that Christ was on the earth. So who has any comments at this point?
Hi, this is Tom. I could make a comment.
Okay, great.
In the 70 weeks, Daniel is actually told that the 70 weeks is divided up into first, it's seven sevens or 49 weeks that are compared to 49 years that will take to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. And then it says there will be 62 weeks, which comes out to 434 years until the time of the Messiah's coming. And the way I look at the time of Messiah's coming is actually until his birth. And some people think it's the time of his ministry, but I believe it's the time of his birth, because the introduction of Messiah at his birth is announcing the arrival of the king. So that would be the anointed one. He doesn't have to be baptized to be anointed, because he is filled with the Holy Spirit. He is the Messiah at the time of his birth and the promised coming of the king. And that's how he's celebrated by the angels. And then there's a gap in time where there's silence until he begins his ministry, because there's no biblical writings about the time of his early childhood up until age 30 when he is baptized by John. And then if you look at the 70 weeks, you'll notice that there's 1 week missing, the final week. And that's where you come into question that you were mentioning about who is making the covenant. And biblically, it would be referring to the Antichrist as making a covenant, but that a covenant is made after the true Messiah is taken away and he possesses nothing. So then you have a question. The anointed one came. He was announced at his birth as a promised Messiah. He came and began his ministry at age 30. And then you have a question, well, what is the time period of his ministry? Did it last 3.5 years? Or some people are questioning, maybe it's only a 1 year ministry. But in my view, what's happening in Daniel is he's demonstrating that there's actually two different, the number seven, the final week that has to be performed. And here Messiah only has 3.5 years to do his ministry, and then he dies and he's taken away. So he did not complete that week. And then the Antichrist comes at the very end time, and he completes a week where he begins a ministry. And for 3.5 years, there's a covenant. And then halfway through that covenant, he breaks it. And then there's the end time tribulation. So then there's an end time week performed by an Antichrist. But Messiah begins a week for 3.5 years. And then at the end time, there's Revelation where it talks about Messiah will preserve his people for 3.5 years during the tribulation. So then in that way, Messiah does complete that Daniel end time 1 week period. So there's two different weeks running together, the true Messiah's end time week and then the Antichrist's end time week.
Okay. So does anybody have any comments on that?
I do. This is Sean.
Okay, great.
The only problem with that is it can't be two separate weeks. A week is always in, you know, refers to in the word or root word of Sabbath or Sabbaton, weeks or 7 days. That is a week. So even in the period of prophecy, when we're looking at Daniel's 70th week, that last week, it's still in terms of a seven, but where you have two halves of a week, 3.5 and 3.5. That is the last week, the last week of Daniel, the time of the great tribulation, the 3.5 years, and 3.5 years, which people confuse and say it's 7 years of great tribulation. So I understand what you're saying. I don't know, even when you're explaining it or your version of it, these questions just instantly raise up in my mind. Well, you're saying that 3.5 is a week. When in any kind of pattern is 3.5 a week? 3.5 could be half of a week. Even when we have times, times, and half of times, that's that 3.5 that we're talking about, 3.5 years. And which leads us to the middle of the tribulation. And then the latter half of that is the great tribulation that lasts 3.5 weeks or 3.5 years. So I corrected myself. So 3.5 years. I don't see how it's 1 week for Hasatan and then 1 week is representing the 3.5 years of ministry for Yeshua. I'm of the mindset, I'm open to it being 3.5 years as what's traditionally found. But if you line up the that at times chronologically through the Gospels, it doesn't show 3 years or 3.5 years. If you line them up chronologically, it answers some of these questions I saw in someone's paper asking, well, why could it be all these other Gospels are, you know, leaning towards multiple events, and these events seem to happen chronologically. But if you line the Gospels up chronologically, that math doesn't work, and it's like a year to a year and a half. But I still don't see the relevance of what difference would it make whether it was a year, year and a half, 3 years, 3.5 years as far as his ministry. The only time it makes any difference is if you're assigning it a value in eschatology and saying that these 3.5 years represents the week of Christ and these three and a half years represent the time of Hasatan or the time of this false covenant or broken covenant. So it's basically people supporting a narrative on their idea of eschatology. That's all I have to say.
Okay.
Hi, this is Tom. In Daniel 9, chapter 9, verse 27, where it says he will make a strong covenant for 1 week, and that would be compared to 7 years, and that says halfway through that week he will break the covenant, and then he will bring devastation or destruction until the end. So that's where you see the division of that week, which is considered a 7-year period, and halfway through the week would be 3.5 years. So that's where I get the division of 1 week into 3.5 and 3.5. And then I compare it to Messiah's ministry that began his ministry on the Day of Atonement, announcing the Jubilee year. And that would, if you count to Passover, 3 plus 1/2, you get 3.5 years. From atonement around 3 times, and then the Passover is 3.5 years. So that's how I count it. But then Messiah would not have completed a 7-year required for that Daniel 70 weeks. So he'd have to complete the final 3.5 at the end time when there's a separation between the people of that are faithful to Messiah and those who are marked with the mark of the beast. So the people with the mark of the beast go through the tribulation. Those who do not have the mark are protected. So that would be the completion of Messiah's final week in that final 3.5 year period.
Right. Let's see. Then you're actually begging the conclusion that we even have this time gap within the 70th week. So not only is there a time gap in the week itself, right? So we have 69 weeks completed, then we have the Daniel 70th week. And there's a time gap between the 69th and the 70th, then there's also a time gap within that 70th week from when it began to when it ends.
Yes.
All right. That's hard to prove, and it's highly speculative, and it only fits in your version or your call to speculation. It only fits there. So it raises a big red flag for me.
Okay, so before we go too much farther, Paul, I think you were going to say something a little bit ago. Did you want to comment now?
Yes, I did want to comment. I'm going to start out with verse 24 again. Okay, 70 weeks are determined upon thy people. Daniel's a Jew here. The Jewish nation are a people. And we know in the book of Acts that the gospel goes to the Gentiles, correct? The Jews are part of it, too, but I'm just saying the Jews that will not accept Christ are left out of the new covenant, so to speak.
No, they're not.
Well,
they're not. And the gospel doesn't go to the Gentiles. The gospel came to the Jew first and then to the Gentiles.
That's correct.
So, but what you're presenting is replacement theology.
Okay, well, let me just go along here. You don't mind.
Well, you asked the question. I don't mind at all, but you asked the question.
Oh, okay, so okay. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you answered that. So 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, okay, and upon thy holy city, Jerusalem, to finish transgression. Jesus finishes transgression. To make an end of sins. He's the one that can wash away our sin. And to make reconciliation for iniquity. He reconciles our sins once more in a different way. And to bring in everlasting righteousness, He is the only everlasting righteous one, to seal up the vision and the prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Now, we know that Jesus was anointed, I believe, in the book of Luke. He is anointed by the Holy Spirit when he's baptized by John the Baptist. In Luke chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, "Now in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate being governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of," I can't say that name, "and of the region of Tenoculus and Silanius and whatever." Anyway, so in the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar, we know the 15th year is 27 A.D. So we know that that's when John the Baptist is baptizing. And then it comes to Jesus being anointed. He has anointed me to preach the gospel. I think that's in
Luke 4:18.
Thank you. You're really helpful. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, recovering of sight to the blind, and to set at liberty them that are bruised." So he has anointed me, it says here. I feel he was anointed when he was baptized and the Holy Spirit came upon him. Okay, so far, so good. Okay, so in 70 weeks, all this has to happen. We've got to know where to start the 70 weeks. The next verse in Daniel chapter 9, verse 25, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Okay, so we got to find the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem. And that's found in Ezra chapter 7, from 12 to 26. That's the command by Artaxerxes to rebuild Jerusalem. The commandment by Cyrus to rebuild the temple was much earlier than this. It was in 536 B.C. And then Darius, about 20 years later, gives the commandment again, build that temple. Cyrus said to build that temple, and I want that temple built. And the temple finally gets built after 23 years of them working on it. That's the history that Thompson gives anyway, about 23 years to build the temple. So then the Jerusalem lays desolate here for a lot of years, and finally Artaxerxes makes this commandment in Ezra chapter 7 to rebuild Jerusalem. He wants it built. And we find out in Nehemiah, which is several years later, Artaxerxes makes a second commandment because his first commandment is not listened to. And Nehemiah goes up to him and he says, "The gates are burnt. The wall is not up." And Artaxerxes says, "Build that city, king of Persia." So we have two decrees from Artaxerxes to build Jerusalem. And it says right here, in verse 25, I'm going to read it again, of Daniel chapter 9. "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem until the Messiah the Prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Well, if you add 69 weeks together, that makes 483 years. 483 years from 457 B.C. when that commandment was done brings you to 27 A.D., There is no year zero. You guys can figure that out yourself. But there's no history for the year zero. It's either 1 B.C. or 1 A.D. So you have to subtract one number when you're doing your math. Okay, so that brings you to 27 A.D. when Jesus was baptized. According to Luke chapter 3, John the Baptist started baptizing then. And it says Daniel chapter 9, verse 25 again, because I want you to read it here about the wall. "The street shall be built again, and the wall, even in troublous times." Well, if you study Ezra and Nehemiah, you will find that there are many enemies of Jerusalem and of Judea, and they're harassing them and threatening to attack them so that the workers have to work with their sword, their bow, and their spear at their side as they're building the wall and as they're rebuilding Jerusalem. And we know that from the first commandment that Artaxerxes put till the next one is at least 14-15 years. And then we know that Nehemiah came there and helped Ezra finish the job. And so we have no exact timetable as to the 49 years that it took to build Jerusalem back. We do have a celebration at the end of Nehemiah. saying that the walls are built and they have a dedication to rebuilding Jerusalem. So anyway, God was with them there. So I don't know how you put that in Christ's ministries, that the street shall be built again and the wall even in troublous times. I don't know if you want me to keep going, Cole.
Well, I think it is really incredible that there is this period of 483 years that goes from the going forth of the command to rebuild, and then from the time that he is, I guess it goes right to his baptism, is that right? Or something
that's
right
correct.
Around that range. And so that's pretty incredible. To me, that is a very significant fulfillment of that prophecy in Daniel. So it shows the 7 weeks, which I think what you're saying is that it's, you know, things are in construction, so there's kind of like a designated 7 week approximate period. I mean, it's probably exactly, but I'm just saying, like, as far as we can tell, it seems to be reasonable that could be about a 49-year period, and then 62 weeks is these other, whatever that comes out to, 400 and whatever number of years that brings us to the time of the baptism of the Messiah. And so that's pretty cool. So the last part is that kind of mysterious week, I guess, that 7th week, the 7 and the 62 seem in that prophecy to be pretty straightforward, but that's why I usually get my understanding gets kind of blurred around 69. that's where it kind of goes all different directions for me. But anyway, so why don't you keep going just kind of quickly, and then we'll open it up and love to hear some other thoughts. And I know that Andrew has made a couple comments here, but I know I wanted to make sure to get some things from him on the significance of this as well, and then specifically tying it then to the length of the ministry of the Messiah. So, but yeah, why don't you go ahead for a couple more minutes here, Paul?
Okay, I'm gonna go to verse 26, Daniel chapter 9, verse 26. And after 62 weeks, the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. Did Jesus die for himself, or did he die for me and you, Cole?
For us.
Yeah, he died for us.
Yeah.
So, and the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. If you look up this word sanctuary in the Hebrew, this is God's sanctuary. It's never used for Satan's sanctuary. So the prince shall come and shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. This is the prince. If you understand that Titus destroys the city, and he is going to be the future emperor of Rome when his father dies. So Titus becomes emperor, but during this time he is the general. He actually does not want to destroy, according to Josephus, who made a complete history of this destruction. According to Josephus, Titus had told them, do not destroy that temple, the soldiers. But it got on fire anyway because the Jews hid in there. Anyway, that's a little longer story. But so that's God's sanctuary there. So the prince there is Titus, emperor, who destroyed Jerusalem in 70 A.D. You can look that up in the history books. Okay, and then I'm going to go on from there. And the end thereof shall be with a flood. And if you understand flood in the Bible, it's often an army, which was the Roman army. And unto the end of the war, desolations, notice the desolations are plural. So there's more than one desolation coming. This is the first one. Rome is a desolating power, pagan Rome. And then papal Rome will be the next desolating power. But this is pagan Rome here, are determined. Okay, so okay, now the last one, verse 27. Of Daniel chapter 9. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week. So we have one more week to go. We got to go to 34 A.D. And in the midst of the week shall he cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. Jesus dies in the middle of the week. And when he dies, he is the sacrifice. He died for our sins. He is the fulfillment of the sacrifice. And so the sacrifice and the oblation, which is a sacrifice also, to cease. And for the overspreading of abominations, notice again, it's plural. There's not one abomination. He shall make it desolate even until the consummation. I believe that word consummation, I believe that is the wedding of the Lamb, when the church, us, are made ready to meet Christ. That's the second coming of Christ. And that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So we know that Jerusalem is destroyed in 70 AD, so 40 years after Christ dies, 39 and some months, we have the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. And so this is what in Matthew 24 is, when you see the army surrounding Jerusalem, you know you're supposed to flee to the hills of Judea. Well, the army surrounded Jerusalem in 67 A.D., and then they were called away by a civil war that was happening in Rome, in which the Apostle Paul was killed. We believe he was beheaded at that time in 67, according to the history books that, you know, that cannot be confirmed by the Bible, and I understand that. And so when that army called away, the Christians get out, because the Jewish army pursues the Roman army and almost destroys it. You can read all this in Josephus. But anyway, just so you understand, I think I'm done.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what, before we go on and I open it up for questions, I just wanted to mention that if you're listening and you'd like to contribute, you'd like to give us some feedback, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us through our website, truthrestoration.com. Again, that's truthrestoration.com, and we would love to hear from you. And so now I just wanted to open it up for a few minutes. Paul, you went over a lot of things right there, and I want to talk to Andrew in a few minutes to see how his thoughts and how things relate to the 70-week ministry of the Messiah. But in the meantime, does anybody have any questions or comments at this point?
Hi, this is Tom. I was wondering from Paul on Messiah being announcing the year of Jubilee. Does he see that announcement occurring on the Day of Atonement according to Leviticus chapter 25, verse 5 through 10, or 8 through 10, where it talks about the announcement of the Jubilee year on the Day of Atonement? Is that when you view it as happening?
I actually, you know, and this is kind of difficult, Colt, because you're right. The Jubilee is a full year, and it starts with the Feast of Tabernacles, and that is true. Totally correct. This part, I'm willing to be corrected, but that's the way I read it. But I believe that the Jubilee, the captives were set free when Christ died on the cross. The total Jubilee comes when Christ takes his bride back up to heaven at his second coming. I believe that would be the climax of the Jubilee. Anyway, that's just kind of the way I see it.
What I was trying to mean is that, as far as I understand, the Jubilee year is actually announced on the Day of Atonement, but it actually doesn't begin until the first day of the month of Abib, which would be the following spring. So they actually announced the Jubilee year early, about 5 months earlier, before the Passover season. So as far as I understand, it's a pre-announcement, because in that verse it tells you that the Jubilee is announced on the Day of Atonement on the 10th day of the 7th month, but it actually doesn't begin until the first month of the year, which would be the month of Abib, the springtime. So then that's when Jubilee begins, and then it runs for a whole year.
Well, we know that Christ, he was God, and he loved us so much that he died on that cross for us. And he could have bailed out, I believe. I think the temptation was real. He could have really bailed out. You know, he sweat blood. It was a tough decision even for him to be separated from his father and die and then raise himself from the dead, or God raise him, whatever you want to say. He is God. But anyway, he's a wonderful God. He loves us. And this was all predicted in Isaiah 53, you know, that he would be the lamb slain. And he's the one that sets the captives free. And it says right after in Corinthians, I believe, it says that he set the captives free. And we know that there was people resurrected at his death, and resurrection we have one Bible text to that in Matthew, which is a wonderful text which I would love to hear more about, but God has seen in the fit that we're not to hear too much about that resurrection. We know that they went into the city and preached the gospel, I'm sure. But thanks for telling me that it didn't start till the first month of next year.
Okay, well, I guess what I'm curious to do is the last little bit of time here that we have is to kind of get a little more specifically into the Messiah's ministry, and then how this potentially, the same prophecy, the way I see it is that there can certainly be multiple fulfillments of a prophecy, and in the one in Daniel here, I think the way you spelled it out there, Paul, as far as the 490 years, I think that makes pretty good sense right up through, you know, his crucifixion, his resurrection. The only thing is, it gets a little fuzzy for me at the end there. I'm just not totally clear on that. But what
can I just make one comment?
Sure, sure.
The comment I forgot to give you was that in 34 A.D., if 27 A.D. is the beginning of his ministry in the last week, then 34 A.D. has to be the end. And if you look in the back book of Acts, Stephen was stoned about 3.5 years into the ministry, into after Christ died. And then, therefore, the gospel, there was great persecution in Jerusalem, and it said the gospel went out everywhere to the Gentiles. You know, this is when Peter gets his dream. This is when the gospel goes to the Gentiles.
Yeah, and Paul's on the road to Damascus, and that whole thing happens, and he's kind of the main messenger, it seems, to the Gentiles. And so
that's correct.
So I see what you're saying there, and that could fit. I really don't have any major objections as far as that. I think it also fits, that same 70-week prophecy also fits with his ministry, because that's where I was curious if Andrew wanted to kind of summarize that or talk about that for a minute. But did you want to just give a quick kind of overview of how the prophecy in Daniel, the 70-week prophecy, fits in with the Messiah's potentially 70-week ministry?
I'll share what I think about it.
Okay, great.
It's a problem to me to take a Daniel's prophecy and try to figure out a chronology or a length of time of his ministry from Daniel's prophecy instead of going straight to the gospel and letting it speak for itself, because Daniel he wasn't an eyewitness, but Luke was, and he understood it. So to get a correct chronology or even a length of ministry would be one of the four gospels you get it from. What happens is when you go to Daniel and you try to build off from that, you could come to multiple different conclusions on it. Would always be confusing. I haven't studied Daniel 9 that much. I mean, the 70-week thing kind of stands out to me because I believe in an acceptable year ministry. But okay. I guess the importance of an acceptable year is, for the chronology itself, it's painting a picture of two seasons. You got the acceptable year season and the one before it, which was the making straight of the way, and it kind of rolls out that way. Like Shama said, it rolls out in a yearly fashion instead of a massive gaps of time missing. But I guess that's my conclusion on Daniel 9.
Okay. Well, so then what I'm real curious is, like, the last little bit here, I know the feasts have all kinds of significance, obviously, with his life and his ministry and everything that we do and everything. The feasts are all over as far as the gospel. But so I'm just curious if you could maybe, if you want to, just to kind of give, because I know a lot of times people say, okay, there was 3 Passovers. And so how do you see, and I know you sent that paper out, and if anybody is listening and you'd like to get a copy of that, again, just contact us, send me an email through their website, truthrestoration.com, and we've got this paper that was put together that is pretty intriguing. It's pretty interesting. It's really neat the way it kind of spells out some of the differences and where those differences take place in the chronology of the Gospels from a 70-week ministry or a 3.5-year ministry. And so, but how would you kind of spell out in a nutshell, Andrew, the feast going through his ministry and looking at it according to the feast?
In that paper, on the right-hand side, you would have the 3.5-year perspective, the most common one. And then on the left side would be the acceptable year perspective. And both of them go off of Luke being in order. So once you lay that foundation out and you see where the 3.5-year starts, the time of the imprisonment of John really throws out of whack the second Passover, which in the 3.5-year would be John 5. So when they move Luke, when John's cast into prison, the next thing that happens is he proclaims the acceptable year. So if you take that section and put it in between the first Passover and John 5, you have created a whole year of empty space. And then within that year, you're proclaiming that he proclaimed the acceptable year, and that year comes and goes. And then a new year begins, and then you got another whole year and a half after that one. So in a 3.5-year chronology, you have that problem of the acceptable year being proclaimed and passing by, where most people would say, well, the acceptable year would be the one he was crucified in. It wouldn't be just the first random year and then come and go like nothing happened, you know. But from a 70-week perspective, he's baptized, he goes to the first Passover, talks to Nicodemus, goes out into the wilderness of Judea, and we don't insert Luke at that point. We let that story continue on all the way through John 5, which makes John 4, the counting of the Omer, the seven sevens in between that period, and John 5 being Shavuot, or Pentecost. Then the acceptable year is preached. So the acceptable year from the 70-week version would begin right after Pentecost and continue all the way to the next Pentecost, which would be Acts 2. That's your acceptable year. The point up to the proclamation of the acceptable year would be the making straight the way period. Are you following me?
Yeah, yeah, no, I think so. So basically, somewhere when he's around 29 or so years old, or 30, somewhere right in that range, is where we have, like, John chapter 1, Luke chapter 3, and that's where he's baptized, the Spirit's descended, and then he goes out in the wilderness, and then he comes back, and then basically, right around that time is, I think, John chapter 2, and that's that first Passover that's mentioned chronologically in the Gospels. Is that right?
Right. So when he comes out of the wilderness, he's in the Galilee, and you see him go to Cana for the wedding, and then he goes back to Capernaum for not a few days, and then he hightails it all the way up to Jerusalem for Passover, the first one.
Okay.
So there's not a much period of time there. He comes out of the wilderness, does a few things, and then heads straight to Passover.
Okay.
From there, he heads straight into Judea to baptize. And that's where him and John are out baptizing together. And the Lord, I'm paraphrasing some Bible in front of me, it says, the Lord noticed that he was baptizing more than John. And that's when John decreased and he increased. And then some point in that seven-week period of counting the Omer, John is cast into prison. He doesn't sit in prison for that entire year, as the three-and-a-half year would suggest. He's only in prison through the summer months. And actually, when he gets beheaded and they find out about it, that's when the fall feasts really begin. That's when the feeding of 5,000 comes into play, and that's when they all line back up together, all four Gospels.
Okay, well, great. Hey, now we're getting into the thick of it, which is fine. But before we continue on, we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back in just a moment to continue on the conversation. If you'd like to get more information about our conference calls, please contact us through the website, truthrestoration.com.
Our world needs caring professionals to make a positive impact in our communities. Simpson University's Master's in Counseling Psychology degree prepares you for a career in marriage and family therapy. Our award-winning faculty brings practical clinical expertise and research into the classroom. Attend classes in the evening and earn your degree in just 2 years. Be empowered to make a difference. Call today at 1-888-9-SIMPSON or visit us online at simpsonu.edu.
Okay, welcome back to the Truth Restoration Bible Study Conference Call. Thanks for being with us, and love to hear from you. Again, if you're listening on the radio and you'd like to contact us, please do so through our website, truthrestoration.com. So we're going to continue in the conversation. We're just kind of getting into some of this chronology in the Gospels and with the Messiah's ministry. And many say, I believe, that right at the beginning of John chapter 5, that's a Passover. And I don't think that's the way it fits in with the 70-week ministry, but I'm curious to see if anybody has anything to say about that as we continue on.
Hi, this is Tom.
Hey, Tom.
That's the way I look at it, is John chapter 5, verse 1 is a Passover. And previously in John chapter 4, verse 45, I think it is, it's talking about that it was sometime after the feast. So it's looking at another feast, a major feast, and there's actually three feasts that you could have that you're required to come to the Jerusalem. One was unleavened bread, the other is Pentecost, and the other is Tabernacles, were the three major feasts. But as far as I can look at it, the feast that's mentioned in John 4, verse 45, it would be the Feast of Tabernacles, and then the next one would be Passover. And then after that, in John, I think it's chapter 6, it's talking about tabernacles again. So it's that cycle of feasts. You go back and forth, you know, Passover, and then tabernacles, Passover, tabernacles. But he doesn't seem to mention Pentecost. And if you look at the cycle, Pentecost wouldn't fit. You can't make it really fit well in that series of events. So I'd believe that, at least the way I look at John 5, verse 1, is Passover there.
Okay, great. So in your perspective, which is kind of a general 3.5-year perspective of the ministry of the Messiah, John chapter 5, 1 is a Passover, and that's the one I was kind of mixing that up in my head, actually, with John chapter 6, because 6 is where it mentions specifically Passover, but John 5 could be Pentecost, Shavuot, or something else, and so that's what I was curious. So Andrew, John 5 is pretty much open for debate. Is that how you'd see it as well?
Right. There's no indication in itself, like a lamb or, you know, like most of the feasts, you hear the name of the feast, Tabernacles or something along them lines. But John 5 is pretty open to any man's guess, I guess. But if you take John 5 and compare it to the Pentecost in Acts 2, the message that Peter's saying is pretty close to what the message Jesus is saying. That's okay. About all the evidence I would have to suggest it's a Pentecost, because when you compare the two, we know Acts 2 is a Pentecost, so when you take that and you compare it, they're pretty close to teaching the same message.
Okay.
Pardon me, but are you saying that Acts 2 is being used along with the Gospels to set a chronology? Or are you just saying, are you comparing Acts 2?
No, I'm just comparing. I'm saying if I had any evidence to suggest that John 5 was Pentecost, I would personally use Acts 2 because they're very similar. I can't say for a fact that John 5 is Pentecost because there's nothing in there written saying that it is. But what evidence I could come up with would be comparing Acts 2, which is a Pentecost, to it.
I see. Okay. So what is the strong comparison? Is it verbiage? Is it grammar?
Just the message itself, I guess. Not so much grammar or anything like that. It was just kind of what the topic was when they were talking.
Right. So what seems to relate each other? That's what I'm, when I'm reading in John 5, all that we have is there's a Greek word that just means the feast day, right? So it's a feast day of the Jews. So the openness could be, well, is it a high feast day? It's definitely one of the Moedim, but is it one of the high Sabbaths, meaning unleavened bread, Shavuot, or, you know, Yom Kippur?
Because it says it's the Sabbath, I kind of lean towards the seventh Sabbath of the counting of the Omer, the last Sabbath. It doesn't say it's a high Sabbath, so I would assume that they would say high Sabbath if it was, but it could be just the weekly last Sabbath, because we know the Feast of the Jews was nigh, so he went to Jerusalem, and he's there in Jerusalem at that point, and it is the Sabbath, so my guess would be the seventh Sabbath.
Okay. And the seventh Sabbath meaning the very last Feast of Weeks, meaning Shavuot. That's what you're saying.
Right. Okay. That would be my guess. Yeah.
Right. So where in John 5, does it link the last Sabbath of the weeks? Where it gets into him healing the man on the Sabbath in John 5:9?
I guess. Because I'm assuming that John chapter 4 is a total of 7 weeks, or almost 7 weeks, what's recorded in there, I'm just taking a guess that that's what occurred on those weeks. So at this point, he was out in the wilderness baptizing with John for an undetermined amount of time. It could have been 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 5 weeks, who knows. And then hightails it through Samaria, talks to the woman at the well, goes up to Cana or Capernaum, and then turns around and goes right back. So I'm thinking it's like later on in those weeks that's why I'm thinking that's the seventh one. Because it would have took a lot of time traveling up and around and back down again, plus all the time he spent baptizing.
Right. So you're looking at John as being written chronological, like all of these events in John happened chronologically. Because we would have to assume that to be true in order for that conclusion to be true, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
So I would say when John 1 starts all the way to the end of John 5, there should be no breaks at all from any of the other Gospels. He's just telling a continuous story leading us up to the point where the other three Gospels jump in at the same time and all say John is now in prison and he proclaims the acceptable year. According to Luke, if we use him as the foundation and we just take Mark and set him aside, we see that Mark's all in order too, all through summer periods. They're telling the same exact story pretty much, all in the same order. It's Matthew that kind of has a couple mix-ups there in the summertime where huge sections are moved around, but Luke and Mark are in sync the entire time, except one time, and that's when Peter's mother-in-law was sick. It was out of order just by one story. If you would use Mark to correct him, it would suggest that story happened in
right. So here's Yeah, no, I do. I do. And it's interesting to see what different people view as being chronologically correct, because now you mentioned Matthew being the one chronologically that seems not to fit. But here's the problem. What's known as the synoptic gospels are seen from one perspective is Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptic gospels, and John is not. So it's just, it seems odd as what's accepted as which books are synoptically written, they would normally also be chronologically. So I'm putting a presumption out there. So if we assume that each of these gospels are written in a chronological order, if they're written synoptically, then they would also be written chronologically. That fits within the same synoptic view, right? But so we have, right, even from your perspective, you're saying, well, Matthew doesn't seem to fit chronologically, but they fit synoptically. But then you're saying, well, John fits chronologically but doesn't fit synoptically.
I guess what I would say about Matthew is when I take Luke and lay it out in one straight fashion and then take Mark and lay it next to him and he lines up smoothly, to me he does. I mean, I don't see any major stories that shift. But when you put Matthew into it, that summer months before the feeding of 5,000 is where all the confusion is, where I see where Matthew is completely out of order. But then as soon as those feasts pass, they all pick up on the same page again, and they become in sync again. So it's almost like they all start with the baptism, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then they jump straight to John being in prison. In that summer month period, Luke and Mark are perfect, but Matthew's a little screwed up. And then when they line back up together after the fall feast, that's when Matthew comes back in order again. So the only part of Matthew I find to be out of order is just the summer months there, not the entire book.
Yeah. Have you, by any chance, have you read the chronological Bible that Rude presented?
Oh, yeah, the 70-week one?
I've read the 70-week one. But in it, he believes that he finds the common point between all the Gospels. And there's one point in all the Gospels that you can then layer one Gospel on top of the other one.
Feeding of 5,000 is what he concludes.
Yeah, I believe that's true. I read it, but I can't remember everything that he wrote. I found it insightful, and I don't agree with everything that he says, but I found it to be insightful. But, you know, if you pin off of that one specific event that lines up with every one of the Gospels, and then once you do that, only then can you set the chronology. So what I'm saying is each book, I don't believe each book is precisely chronological. I think there's major events that you can set chronologically from each book going off of one center point. But each of the books, there's inconsistencies from chronological perspective that just doesn't fit. So I don't think any of the Gospels are written chronologically.
Andrew, why don't you answer that? I'm curious what you have to say about that last statement that Sean said. And then I've got a couple things to say, and then we'll open up for just like 2 minutes, and then we'll close it out. But why don't you answer what Sean said about none of the books being written chronologically?
Yeah, in my own study, I've come to the conclusion to think that they are. And with Michael Rood's pinning it together on the feeding of 5,000, because the feeding of 5,000 is the only time all four books line up at a specific point in time and tell the same exact story. That's John, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And he uses that one for lining up the fall season. Michael Rood kind of teaches it from a, like you said, agricultural perspective. So from Michael's viewpoint, what we went through earlier was the springtime and then the summer. And now when he gets to the feeding of 5,000, he actually pinpoints the day in his theory is that's the sighting of the seventh moon, the last great day. And he shows that on that day, the teaching was about that. And then you get John 6. So he uses John 6 to show that this is not spring, or 6-4, I'm sorry, Passover. This is not a springtime period. What we're about to follow through with Luke and Mark and Matthew is that 10 days later, he's on the Mountain of Transfiguration, and they're talking about building tabernacles, and then he sends them forth to tabernacles, and he shows up, and then he goes through the rest of the story showing how this is a fall season. by using that 5,000. And then it goes into dedications and then into back to springtime. So I don't know. I mean, I agree with them on a lot of things as far as chronology goes. It kind of makes sense to me when you look at it from the agricultural perspective, because there is a lot of indications on times of years and what's going on. And I mean, there's a million different ways to come at it, but it seems more clear to me that it would be a nice, smooth cycle. And that's what it reads like to me, compared to one with massive year-long sections completely missing.
Yeah. No, definitely. You know? Me too. And what I mentioned a little bit ago was that John 6:4, and I was just going to read that at least one place that I had looked at here, it says that the oldest fragment, that the critical apparatus of the nestle, aland, or whatever, had for that chapter, that verse was missing. So if the oldest fragment preserved the original, then that verse was not original to John, but added later by some scribe. And that's speaking of John 6:4. So if that's true, then, you know, it could very well be what you're saying. And that then I think, if I'm not mistaken, that's kind of like the one verse that would kind of put an extra Passover in there. And if it's really not a Passover, but it actually is trumpets or whatever else would have kind of consistently followed after John 5, if that was a Pentecost, and then trumpets was after that, and it kind of goes right through the Day of Atonement with the Transfiguration. So I wanted to get a little farther on today, but we're totally out of time. So maybe we can pick it up there in a week or two and for the recording and continue on and kind of continue this conversation. But kind of a lot to think about, especially for somebody like I was a little while back, just that always heard, you know, 3.5 year ministry and never anything else. And so maybe for some that are listening, I think the 70-week makes a lot of sense. I think it's very intriguing. I think it fits with the feasts and the way they kind of follow through there. And like I said, that one verse that could throw a little problem, it actually, you know, may not, because whatever the case. But anyway, so I just, before we close it out, does anybody have any last thing just real quick that you wanted to get in there before we close this part out?
Yes, the oldest Bible known is the Catholic Bible from Alexandria, Egypt. It says Passover in the Catholic Bible. None of the reformers, Martin Luther, Tyndale, Calvin, all those guys that reformed, Roger Williams and all them, they came out of the Catholic Church. They were even, some of them, Catholic priests. None of them would take the Catholic Bible. They all used the Protestant Bible, the one that came from Antioch, Assyria. They're called the Assyrian Bible. Anyway, both of those, they both agree here, and I believe the oldest scriptures, if you look at anything, is the Catholic Bible from Alexandria, Egypt. And both of them have Passover in that text. And I looked it up in the Blue Letter Bible, which is the Hebrew, and it's got the word Passover there, so I don't, just for whatever that's worth.
What do you mean it has the word Passover? Does you mean the translation is Passover?
Yeah, the translation is Passover, and if you go back to the Hebrew word...
The Hebrew word is Pesach.
Thank you. Yeah, P-A-S-K-H-A in pronunciation.
Well, that's Latin. That's Pascha, but it's Pesach is Hebrew. Pascha is Latin.
Okay, well, anyway, it's got the Hebrew symbols here. It's H6453, whatever that's worth.
Mm-hmm. Pesach.
Okay. And which is Passover, usually translates Passover. So anyway, just for whatever that's worth, I wanted to let you notice that the two Bibles that were in great controversy, whether it would be Catholic or whether it would be what we call the Protestant Bible, the King James Bible and stuff like that, those both agree on this one text.
Okay.
On Andrew's 70 weeks, what time does he actually say it? The ministry, the acceptable year begins, is he saying Pentecost? And does it run from Pentecost to Pentecost? Is that what he's saying? Or when's the beginning, when's the end?
What I'm saying is that making straight the way began at the baptism to the first Pentecost. And then right after that Pentecost occurred, see that John's cast into prison and Jesus, according to Luke, heads straight to Nazareth, opens the book, proclaims the acceptable year. So right after Pentecost, he proclaims it in Nazareth, and then from that point on, all the way to the next Pentecost would be Acts 2, which completes the 70 weeks.
So you're saying Messiah's baptized around Pentecost, and then he's in the wilderness for 40 days, tempted? No.
No.
So
no,
when is that?
He's baptized in the wilderness roughly 60 days before the first Passover, because he spends 40 of the days in the wilderness, and then we would assume that it's close. So I would say that when he says, "Behold the Lamb of God," that the first time, on the first day, when he came out of the wilderness, could have been Aviv 1. So that leaves 14 days for him to go to the wedding, go to Cana or Capernaum for not many days, and then travel all the way to Jerusalem, because that's the only record of what we have in John of what's going on at that point.
Okay. Well, hey, that makes sense to me, and we are out of time for today, but we'll pick it up next time and maybe be able to have the opportunity to finish through the chronology of the Gospels. And so, again, it's fun and love to have you. If you're listening, to join us, you can contact us through our website, truthrestoration.com. Again, to find out how to join us next time, visit truthrestoration.com. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you have an awesome day. We'll see you next time.